He and his family have done more to change the diet in this country than anybody. I kind of look at it from this point of view. You know, they talk about Henry Ford being the inventor of the automobile. He didn't invent the automobile. You know, you look back in history, everybody knows when they studied in grade school, he didn't invent the automobile. What did he do? He brought it to the average person, Henry Ford did. And it's the same thing with healthy eating. The gentleman that I'm going to introduce you to today, he and his family did not invent the diet. No, I mean, in fact, you can go back to the first chapter of Daniel in the Bible, and you can read about a diet based upon pulses and water, starches, vegetables, and fruits. And you can look at the macrobiotic program of the 16th century. You can look at the natural hygiene movement of the early 18th century. And so all of this has, you know, worked out the importance of diet, and slight variations are made here and there. But it was unimportant because it was not practical. It was not brought to the American public, just like the car. It was not brought to the American public until Henry Ford did it. Well, the Pritikin family brought to the American public a diet that supports health, made it palatable to them, not only from the point of view of good food, but also from an understanding point of view. And that's why Nathan and Robert Pritikin will go down in history as people who made more difference in the health of Americans than anyone else in this country. Robert, welcome to the show.
What an introduction, John. Thank you very much.
Well, that's just the way I feel about you guys. I mean, you really just did it. You know, you made the difference. You made it so that not only have people in general been able to swallow the idea, and I mean that from many, many points of view, but also physicians. I mean, you made it credible for physicians, and you continue to do it day after day after day and report your studies in the scientific journals and bring your message out there. And I'm really proud to know you, Robert.
Well, thank you, John. You know, and also I have to say in turn is that in the early days when everybody was talking high protein, high fat as the way to weight loss, there were very few physicians in the country that were supportive of my dad's concepts, and you were one of them. And I can tell you that that was a tremendous boon to us to have somebody of your credibility being supportive in the early days. It's easy now to be supportive of a low-fat, high-carb diet, but it wasn't then. It was very hostile.
That's true. They've all discovered it, haven't they? You know, Don, no longer, the way the new ideas go, they say, is they first say it's not true, and then they say, well, it's true, but it's not important. And now, and that's the phase that medicine is going into now. Well, we've known it all along. In fact, we've invented this in our laboratories, you know, so we've been using this forever.
They're still not quite there yet.
No.
You know, it's an interesting phenomena right now is that we would just published a paper about a month and a half ago in the American Journal of Cardiology on something called the Deadly Quartet. And this was a real eye-opener to a lot of people in that a lot of people, when they get their cholesterol to a safe range, you know, when they get it to 170 or so, or maybe they're genetically have a lucky cholesterol, even no matter what they eat. And let's say they're on a high-fat diet with a safe so-called safe cholesterol, and they think, well, I just have a few pounds I've got to lose and a little bit of hypertension. It's really a weight problem. It's not my diet so much. And these people that thought that they were at low risk are at very high risk. In fact, I was talking to Bill Castelli of the Framingham Data Pool, and he was talking about the fact that there's as many people that die of a cholesterol level less than 200 than die of a cholesterol level over 300. There's a lot of deaths of heart disease in so-called safe cholesterol levels. And interestingly enough, Norman Kaplan, University of Texas, described four risk factors that if you have them, even if you have a so-called safe cholesterol level, you're at high risk for heart disease. And he dubbed it the Deadly Quartet. And what these are, if you have a 180 cholesterol with a Deadly Quartet, you could be at the same risk as a guy with a 250 cholesterol level with a cigarette hanging out of their mouth. And, of course, these are hypertension, high blood fats or triglycerides, upper body fat, and high insulin levels that rarely is checked in this country.
Well, you know, that's an important problem for a lot of people. In fact, I'd have to say it's a fault of the human design, if I had to pick one. At least I worry about the fact that we all feel we're invincible. And so, you know, we look for things, anything positive to say that this doesn't apply to me, I'm okay. And so people look at their good cholesterols to try and somehow negate the fact that their total cholesterol is high. And, you know, they look at the fact that they're thin, I don't have to worry about anything. I mean, the rationale that goes on in our minds to keep us from making dietary and lifestyle change is tremendous. And when you bring into perspective the fact that it's many things, then at least people can get a fairer assessment. But wouldn't it even be more true and more practical to have people step outside of the tests? I mean, the tests are fine. They give scores and grades and tell you how you're doing. But step outside of the tests and really assess how well you're doing with your diet and exercise program Isn't that the bottom line?
It really is, because what I think is so important, and I think you just put your hand on it, for instance, this deadly quartet study, everybody has it fixated in their mind that there's one number, a cholesterol, that's going to tell them whether they're at high or low risk for heart disease. If you're on a high-fat, high-cholesterol diet, even if you have a good cholesterol level, you can still be at high risk. You've really got to make some fundamental changes. As I was mentioning on this study we published, we looked at 57 people with this deadly quartet as they came into the center. 29% of them had the deadly quartet. After 3 weeks, only 5% had the deadly quartet. They're still obese because you count a low-fat diet. You don't lose your weight in 3 minutes. It's not a liquid diet. But they're out of risk. And the point is now they can lose their weight safely. I think people have a hard time understanding. You know, everybody looks for a single villain in life. But a high-fat diet raises so many different risk factors that when they compound together, they give you a terrible risk profile. That just to look at one thing in isolation, like cholesterol, and then maybe take a drug to lower it, while keeping the rest of your risk factors elevated because you're on a high-fat diet, does not give you safety. And I really agree with you, John. We've got to change our perspective on this.
How do the physicians feel about the patients in your group? I mean, here you have, at the Pritikin program, you have more than 100 people that show up there every few days, and these people are the sickest in the country. I mean, these are the people that have been through bypass, are about to go through bypass surgery, they're on handfuls of drugs. I mean, you would think that the doctors in your group would be scared to death. They'd be sitting on edge. They'd be sitting by their telephones waiting for the tragedies to come up all day and all night. That they would be plagued by constant problems with patients. Is that what they find, or is there something different with these
patients? Well, in the old days, there was a lot of fear. When we first started our program back 20 years ago, the physicians that worked with us were very reluctant to respond in the way that we do now. Because when patients, as you know, John, in your center, you find the same thing. People come in with very hypertensive, on all kinds of medication, or on type 2 diabetic, on insulin, and all kinds of drugs. As soon as they go on this program, their need for drugs goes down radically, and you've got to pull them off their drugs or else they'll have an overdose. They'll end up on the floor from low blood pressure or low blood sugar. And most physicians were taught that these are degenerative diseases. You only get worse, so you add more and more drugs. On our kind of program, you have to do just the opposite. And I think what's happened now is that there is such a comfort level amongst our medical group that as soon as a diabetic comes in, be prepared to cut their medication in half. You're going to need to, otherwise their sugar will drop too low on this type of program. And you're getting so used to seeing these very, very sick people improve that the attitude's very, very different.
And besides,
it's a different world than it was 20 years ago. In fact, John, the last two sessions we had two of the top thoracic surgeons in the country as our participants.
Oh, there's a statement. And maybe after they learn it, they'll share it with their patients. But, you know, that's one of the things that I notice all the time is when people come into the clinic, I mean, some of them are really hanging on to a thread, but you get them eating well for a couple of days and you get them off some of the powerful medications and their risk level just plummets and they just don't get into trouble. It's extremely rare for anybody to have difficulty after they start eating well that the benefits of dietary change are so powerful, and that's in great contrast. See, I had the experience as a general practitioner and in my early days as an internist of trying to take care of people with drugs, and I want to tell you, I was up all night long. I was worried all the time about these folks from the side effects they got, and now it's almost like a safe haven when people start the diet or come into the clinic. It just, you know, almost gets rid of the possibility of them having a tragedy. I mean, within hours. And I would guess you see that at your clinic also.
Yeah, we do. In fact, we were just talking before we started the radio show. We just finished publishing a paper in Archives of Internal Medicine looking at almost 4,600 graduates of our program. And the average drop in cholesterol was 23% in 21 days. That's about a percent drop in cholesterol a day. And about a 33% drop in blood fats or triglycerides. It's almost a universal response that when you start feeding your body the fuel that it was intended to have, it allows itself to normalize itself. Tremendous opportunity. In fact, we had 400 people in that study, John, that were over age of 70. We had the same drops in cholesterol in 70-year-olds as you do in 35-year-olds. At any age, when you make a decision to change your diet, you can have a tremendous advantage.
So it's never too late.
Well, for most people. depends how far you get, but it is amazing the ability of the human body to recuperate when you treat it properly.
And I imagine that the physicians there get great satisfaction out of the fact that people get well and appreciate so much what's being done for them, which, again, is in great contrast to the way I practiced medicine 20 years ago. You know, people were dissatisfied, and they deserve to be dissatisfied, because the handfuls of drugs that I pushed on them did not make them well.
No, and in fact, the drugs have such bad side effects, too. Sometimes you can take a drug for hypertension, and it worsens your lipid profile, so you're at more risk for heart disease. And, everything you take has another side effect that you're fighting against. It's really a very sad way to have to deal with illness. You know, one of the things, too, that I find is a lot of people feel that changing my lifestyle or going to a low-fat diet is going to be so difficult. But I don't know, John, on your experience, our experience at our center is that people have a very easy time when they're in the shelter of our program to stay on the diet and exercise. The program's not tough. What's tough is when you go out in the outside world and everything is sort of working against a healthy program. You really have to have your knowledge base together to be successful outside.
Well, that's down in Santa Monica in the L.A. area. Up here in the North Bay area, we don't have that problem at all. Because, no, I'm really serious. I can hardly wait till you come up here again, Robert Pritikin, because it has changed so much in the North Bay area, particularly in the Santa Rosa area where I'm at. We have, we must have 40 restaurants in the area that serve our food. It's hard to go into a restaurant in the area and not be handed a menu that says the McDougal entrees.
Fantastic.
And people, there's so much support in the community because everybody knows somebody or has a relative who is on the program. And they're not just on the program, they're getting phenomenal success. And these people who get success and learn to love the food, just as you and I know it's so easy to do, they're really obnoxious about it, and they're going around trying to get all their friends and relatives to change. And so we've got this great groundswell here in the North Bay area.
Almost like the smoking phenomenon, isn't it?
It is amazing. You know, I can't tell you how good the people in this community make me feel.
Well, it's obviously a progressive area. You know, I think one of the things that makes it easy to be on a low-fat diet is the fact that you don't have to be portion controlling, and you don't have to be counting calories, and that you can eat when you're hungry and eat to your full and be thin. I think that's, if there's anything that's in sync with our behavioral needs, you know, I constantly look at people that are struggling with portion control regimens like all of the weight loss programs are offering, and they're walking around hungry and stressed out and counting calories. That's not the way to try to... That's so out of sync with your behavior.
I got a letter from one of my former patients in Hawaii yesterday, and she's a lady who's going to give me $35,000 to produce a television show for 12-year-old children. And in the letter, she said, John, I want you to remember one thing. 12-year-old children are hungry. They're hungry. I mean, so are 6-year-old children, and so are adults. We are hungry, and you have to eat. And she put it so simply, they're hungry. So wherever you base this message on, make sure they understand, or you understand, that they're hungry and they have to eat. And this is from a lady who's in her 80s, and it's such a simple concept.
Well, I think that the whole concept, one of the big mistakes that people make when they go on a low-fat diet is they don't eat frequently enough. And they try to get by on 2 meals a day like they do on a high-fat diet. That doesn't work on a low-fat diet. I, for instance, I eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and a snack at 10, and a snack at 3, and I have a snack in the evening.
Yes.
It's the only way you can keep your weight up and feel good and full. Otherwise, if you starve yourself, you're going to be in disastrous shape.
And it's so much fun to eat.
That's a terrible side effect of the program. Yeah. You have to eat all the time.
And, of course, you have that lovely dining room there, so you can just walk in and get yourself food. And we have all these nice restaurants in town. In fact, we even have a couple of places that cater food to people in the area. So, you know, tremendous progress is being made up here. And I tell you, it's fun to be involved in this community. Mitch, you're on with Robert Pritikin.
Hi, Doctor. I'm 30 years old, fairly active, and we recently went through a physical, not to include a cholesterol test. Blood pressure is okay and heart rate is low. Is that something that I should be concerned and have something checked?
Yes, everybody should take a cholesterol level, and even children should. In fact, even, and John can verify this too, that one of the great predictors of whether you'll have a heart disease as an adult is what your cholesterol level as a child would be. In fact, in Japan, in the 1950s, the average Japanese child's cholesterol level is around 120 compared to our kids having a level of 160 and 170. And, of course, now with Japanese diet starting to mimic ours, their children's cholesterol levels in the 160, 170 as well. So their honeymoon with regard to heart disease is over. But it is a very good single measurement of whether or not you are at risk for heart disease. However, I do want to reiterate what John was saying earlier. Even if you have a safe cholesterol level, you still should be on a low-fat, low-cholesterol diet. In fact, Stamler from Northwestern University has shown that eating cholesterol is a risk factor to heart disease no matter what your blood cholesterol is. So do take a blood cholesterol, but even if it's good, you should still be on a low-fat diet.
Thank you very much, doctor.
Thank you very much for calling. That's one of the unfortunate things about people is they get these false reassurances, you know, from low blood cholesterol. I guess the way that I hit them between the eyes when they come to me and say, well, look, you know, I eat hamburgers and steaks and eggs and so on. My cholesterol is 130. What I ask them is, what did their parents and grandparents die of? And generally they come back and they say, well, they died of colon cancer some other kind of cancer, which is associated with low cholesterol.
Well, it depends on where, you know, but John, that also depends on what civilization we're looking at.
Oh, yes.
In America, where we're on a high-fat, high-cholesterol diet, low cholesterol levels can be associated with colon cancer, but T.C. Campbell of Cornell, when he got back from studying the Chinese population, that big population study just did, the lower the cholesterol, the less the colon cancer. But again, they're eating 10 to 15% of calories from fat. That's real different than what we're doing.
Right. You added the important ingredient. If you eat the rich Western diet and have a low blood cholesterol,
that's not necessarily great.
That's right. You may end up with colon cancer. You may not die of heart disease. And so if we're taking on insurance just for heart disease, I'll sell it to you. But if we're taking on insurance for your life, no thanks. You eat the rich Western diet, it's going to get you one way or the other.
One of the ways, too, that you can lower your cholesterol level and be on a high-fat diet is to be eating a lot of polyunsaturated fats. And that will, if you're eating low saturated fat, low cholesterol diet, and a lot of polyunsaturated fats, you can have a low blood cholesterol on a high fat diet. But those polyunsaturated fats raise the bile acid levels in the gut. Those breakdown products are known carcinogens. And also on a high fat, low fiber diet, you get these very tight little concentrated stools that will concentrate the toxins and make them irritate the colon. So there are a lot of reasons to go on a low fat diet besides heart disease.
Let's talk to Annie. Annie, you're on the line with Robert Pritikin.
I want to ask you a question. I was listening to you in the car, and I just got home, rushed to the phone to speak with you. I'm a diabetic, and I heard what you said about diabetics, which is just great. But this is a question I want to know. Is there such a place where you can go, like, on vacation? I'm saying vacation, because when there are others like me that need to go on this diet and all, this way it's a lot easier to catch on to what you have to do, so when you get home, it's easier.
You couldn't have paid for a better commercial, Robert.
Yeah, there's two good vacation spots I'd recommend. I'd say either if you could get over to St. Helena, where John is, or if you can get down to Pritikin Longevity Center.
And where is that?
Well, we're in Santa Monica. We're right on the beach.
Oh, I'm just here.
Yeah, well, then I would if you don't want to leave the area, I'd recommend you go to John's. And basically what we do there, and we both do very similar things, we put you on a program that makes your blood sugar, your insulin much more sensitive, much more effective. And we find that, and we've published a number of studies. In fact, we have a paper coming out next month in Journal of Cardiopulmonary Rehabilitation, where we get the majority of type 2 diabetics that are on insulin are able to get off insulin and normalize their blood sugar just from diet and exercise. Oh. And we get almost 90% of those that are on oral medications to control blood sugar off their blood sugar medication with normal blood sugar.
Isn't that exciting?
So there's a tremendous advantage for you to follow this type of program.
And there are also some books that you can get by Robert Pritikin, and his father wrote some books his father's name is Nathan Pritikin, and you can buy those in the store, and they will be a great aid to you and also a stimulus to you to change your diet. And so those of you who can't immediately get to a clinic situation, you have many written sources that you can get involved in. And we have Darlene on the line. You're on with Robert Pritikin. Darlene?
Yes, thank you. You spoke to this a little bit, but I was calling in when you were talking about children and cholesterol level. Two questions. When should they be tested to see what their cholesterol levels are? And is there something in print that I could take to my daughters to share with them?
Well, you know, I was thinking about that with children. Probably the best program that I know of to help with children getting aware of their cholesterol levels is something that the American Health Foundation is putting out. It's their Passport to Health, and that's Ernst Winder's group. And he's got tremendous amount of literature that you can show children. In fact, he's developed stuff for children from grades K through 12, and it's really excellent. It's called the Know Your Body program. And he's now in 50 different schools because his whole cause is to teach children about cholesterol levels. And you might want to, if you want to try to get your school on that.
Well, actually, what I'm really interested in is something to share with my daughters, my grown daughters, for my grandchildren, so that they would know when they should take the children in to have them tested. I think it's a common belief that you don't have children's blood cholesterol taken. And there was a program on television this morning talking about a little girl who was 9 years old who had a cholesterol level of over 300.
Do you have such a family history?
No.
Do you have any general thoughts, Robert Pritikin, on how the general population should react in terms of blood tests? I know you think they should react in terms of diet and what you ought to feed the kids, but how about, do you think that they should go in and get blood cholesterol checks routinely if you don't have a family history of high cholesterol?
Well, I certainly adults should. Every adult in the country should know their cholesterol level. But I think if the parents take a cholesterol level and their diet is good that they're feeding their children and they don't have a family history, I don't know how important it is to routinely test young children's cholesterol levels. But there is, John, I don't know if you want to speak on that, but one of the things that it is important, and a lot of people feel, well, I'll let my children eat what they want, and when they get older, we'll educate them and change their minds. There's a lot of reasons to be on a low-fat diet, even as a child, and particularly with young girls. We're all aware that young men can develop artery disease at an early age. We're aware of the Korean War and Vietnam War autopsy studies where the soldiers that were killed on the battlefield at 18 and 19 years of age already had substantial, and in some cases very aggressive, artery disease, and you compare them to the Vietnamese counterparts that were on a low-fat diet, and their arteries were nice and clean. But there's also a lot of evidence to show that one of the risk factors for breast cancer, which is early menarche, occurs because young girls are put on a high-fat diet. And in fact, in 1860 in our country, the average onset of menarche was about 16 years of age, and now it's 12 years of age. And as we were talking about T.C. Campbell's work in China, the average Chinese girl that's on a 10%, 15% fat diet doesn't go into menarche till 18 years of age. So there are a number of changes that happen to you by going on a high-fat diet that can predispose you to health risk factors. So it is worth having your child start out and learn a low-fat diet. And in particular, health habits start young. And I can tell you, for me, I was brought up on a low-fat diet. It was a lot easier to enjoy and live on a low-fat diet than when you see people coming into the program at 60 years of age on steak and eggs all their life, having to make an abrupt change in lifestyle. So I think it's, if the parents are in good shape, you have a good family history, and your kids are on a good low-fat diet, I think you're doing a pretty good job.
But if you need to scare them, or you need to be scared yourself, I suppose that's a reason to get a cholesterol. But otherwise, I would have to agree. I don't know that we need to routinely go out and check children for their cholesterol level, because the dietary habits and the parents' predisposition to a very serious problem of high cholesterol, which is genetic, would be the indications that there would be something wrong. And you mentioned diseases like breast cancer and uterine cancer associated with starting that diet young at age, and, of course, prostate cancer. But let's not forget constipation and stomach aches and headaches and arthritis and acne and greasy skin, and the 30% of the children out there that are so obese that they get teased by their friends and they have trouble participating in athletics. I mean, these are real things for these kids right now. On the line from Forestville, we have Helen. Hello, Helen.
Yes, good morning. I'd like to ask this question. I know that we're all going to die sometime, but if you follow a diet that you recommend, what do these people do die from?
It's a wonderful question. You know, and you give the answer, Robert, because when you're done, I'm going to tell you what your dad said if you don't give the same answer.
Okay, I know what he would say. He would have said congestive heart failure
right,
at 95.
Right. Yeah.
But let me mention that there are certain studies. For instance, in the Framingham data pool, there's a subset of vegetarians in the group that have average cholesterols in the 120s, 130s, and they live, I think, according to Castelli, almost 8 years longer than the rest of the Framingham group. And I know that the studies of T.C. Campbell of Cornell from China, that they were living in their late 70s, and yet they have, because of public hygiene and problems like that, they have a lot more mortality and so forth. So it seems very reasonable that if you can stop dying at a young age of diseases that you don't need to get, like heart disease and certain cancers, that you will live to our maximal lifespan. And obviously, eventually, your heart would just sort of wear out and you would get congestive heart failure, I guess, would be the natural way to go.
The nice way to go is just go to sleep at night at 90 years of age and not wake up. Just
that's great.
I mean, that is essentially what you should expect to happen if everything works ideal. I had a great-grandmother died at 106, and that's how she went. She died on the day of birth of my youngest son, and we named our youngest son off of her from her first husband. And it was kind of an interesting thing. One of the last things she heard was that we had a little boy named Craig, and then she just went to sleep, and that was it. And that's the way all of us, I think, would like to go. But thank you for calling. Talk to Mary in Santa Rosa. Hello, Mary.
Yes, hello. Dr. Pritikin?
That's Robert Pritikin. I'm not a physician.
Oh,
Dr.
you're not a physician. Nutritionist. Yes. Okay. How long do you think it would take my husband, who's been on high blood pressure medicine, I believe, for... oh, maybe 40 years to come off of it.
Okay, well, first of all, there's no guarantees he'll get off.
No.
We have our published data, and we've done a number of studies with hypertensives. We get about 85% of hypertensives off medication in 3 weeks and normalize their blood pressure on diet and exercise alone, even if they've been on medication for more than a year. That means 15% don't get off. But a majority of those that do not get off medication are able to reduce the dosages and still have normal blood pressure. But in any case,
he had a bypass.
Your risk for heart disease, whether you get off or not.
He had a bypass in 1990.
Well, then he really needs to get on a good program, because there have been many studies that have shown that a bypass has an average life of around 7 years.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. That's why I'm interested.
Yeah,
he's 73.
And the biggest factor to show, and probably some of the best work on this has been done by Dr. Blankenhorn at USC working with bypass patients, that if you can get on a good low-fat, low-cholesterol diet, you can keep those grafts open.
Right.
And if you want to make that operation
This is Dr. Blankenhorn?
At USC.
USC.
Yeah,
because
he's done
he
a
had
lot
a doctor.
Of work in bypass patients, putting them on a diet very similar to what John and I are talking about.
Yes.
And if you want to make that
now,
operation...
Now, does John Dr. McDougall have the same program as you have in St. Louis?
Very, very similar.
Uh-huh. Okay, so... thank you kindly.
One of the things that I hope you heard Robert Pritikin say, Mary, is that even if he doesn't get off his blood pressure pills, there are other things that improve. In other words, the blood becomes thinner, less likely to clot and form a thrombosis, in other words, a heart attack. The cholesterol comes down, the body weight comes down, the insulin levels come down. In general, regardless of whether he gets off the pills or not, his risk of having further damage to his arteries is dramatically reduced. And sometimes I run into problems with people, Robert. They come in after 60, 70 years of abuse, and they want everything solved in 12 days. And I tell them, one of my introductory remarks at a program is that, look, you've got to be mature about what you're going to accomplish. Don't be like my children who get their report card and they see A, and then a C, and all they do is they fret all day about the C that they got. You know, you will get tremendous benefits when you make this dietary and lifestyle change, but you may not solve every single problem that you put upon yourself in 12 or 26 days or whatever the expectation is. So it's time to do it. That's the message, Mary. Save your husband's life, okay?
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And we have Cheryl from Petaluma on the line.
Hello, Dr. McDougall. I'm interested. A friend of mine has just been diagnosed with fibromyalgia, also known as, it has a strange thing called phantom pain. I believe it's degeneration of connective tissue. And I'd like to know anything either one of you know about it.
Go ahead, Robert. Do you see fibromyalgia?
No, this is yours.
Well, you know, let's talk about it in more of a general term. You see people with inflammatory connective tissue diseases like rheumatoid arthritis and lupus and ankylosing spondylitis and nonspecific arthritis.
Right.
And it all kind of fits in the same category. We're really talking about, as far as I'm concerned, the same processes, the same cause, and the same solution. It's an inflammation of the connective tissues, in other words, of tendons and joint sheaths and muscle sheaths and so on. And you can call it fibromyalgia if you want. That happens to be the new click type of diagnosis that's out.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, but still, it's a generalized inflammatory process that results in pain, fatigue, elevated sedimentation rates, sometimes changes in certain blood tests that are consistent with arthritis. What kind of things do you see in terms of arthritis and inflammatory connective tissue diseases at the Pritikin Center?
Well, we have only published one paper on it, John, but we've seen clinically a tremendous change in arthritis patients and just inflammatory process. We published a paper a year ago in looking at the prostaglandin inflammation, which is really what aspirin affects. And we published it in prostaglandins, leukotrienes, and internal medicine, found a dramatic drop in the inflammatory chemical response when you go to a low-fat diet. So there's a real physiological reason for why your inflammatory response drops when you go on a low-fat diet. We've seen people, and you have too, that come in here that are so riddled with arthritis they can hardly walk, and within a week or so they've had more relief than they've had in 20 years of painkillers. So it's not 100% of the time, but it's an amazing fact that people can really reduce these symptoms.
You probably probably came across the October 12th Lancet article, October 12th, 1991, the controlled trial of fasting and 1 year vegetarian diet and rheumatoid arthritis.
Sure did.
And here's a, you know, the proper kind of study that influences doctors and of course should influence all patients, where they put them on a diet similar to what we're talking about, and in just a matter of a week, dramatic improvement in essentially all the patients.
What kind of drugs do you find? He's talking about medicating her. Also, he immediately put her on Premarin. That's
some people's approach to the problems is to try and cover up the symptoms with drugs, and it doesn't work. And as a matter of fact, I can tell you a couple of real important things about drug treatment of inflammatory disease, including rheumatoid arthritis, is it does not induce remission, clearly does not stop the disease, and it does not modify the course of the disease in terms of decreasing the destruction of the joints. And in 20 years, a study by a man named Boyd, that's not his name, forget it, doesn't matter what his name is, in a 20-year study that was published in The Lancet, what they found was that half the patients who had rheumatoid arthritis at the end of 20 years were either dead or so disabled that they were bedridden or wheelchair-bound. Half the patients with the best high-tech Star Wars drug treatment available.
Mm-hmm.
So don't let your friend get duped into thinking that this is the solution to the problem. The solution to the problem is to change the diet, and that solves the arthritic problems in most people. And I have to say, you can only use the word cure for many people with inflammatory arthritis, including rheumatoid arthritis. And I saw a lady a couple days ago with the diagnosis of fibromyalgia, who changed her diet and essentially got rid of all her problems.
Okay, because the one other thing that they're that he's talking about, of course, is her stress level, which I find to be interesting, because as far as I'm concerned, everyone has stress. I find that to be kind of funny. But he said that stress and increases the inflammation at times.
He's trying to blame the patient for the problem instead of dealing with the fact that he doesn't know what's going on. And when you tell a patient, as far as I'm concerned, that their diseases are to their neuroses or stress or emotional problems, what you're saying, what the doctor is saying is, I don't know the cause of your problem, so instead of me admitting that, I will just blame you and tell you you're neurotic, and of course life is tough, so you believe it.
Life is tough, and then tell you not to have stress, but to give you drugs for it.
Yeah, that's right. No, the ultimate insult to the patient, the bottom of the pile, after everything else has been tried, is to send the patient to a psychiatrist and put him on an antidepressant.
Yeah,
that's
put him on Prozac.
When you finally dump the patient to the lowest levels of mistreatment, it's when you send them to the psychiatrist for dietary and lifestyle-caused diseases and put them on antidepressants. Thank you for calling.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Am I on the line?
You are on. Not only are you on the line, you're all over the North Bay area on the most popular talk radio show in the entire North Bay area.
Well, thank you. I have a couple of questions for Dr. McDougall.
Well, we'll ask them of Robert Pritikin. You can talk to Dr. McDougall some other time. But go ahead, ask the questions.
Well, the question is that about 7 months ago, my wife is, I'm 49 years old. I'm in what I consider excellent health. I've got a blood pressure of like 120 over 80. About 7 months ago, my wife had been on the McDougall diet, and I went for something that I didn't even think I needed, a cholesterol check, and found that I had a cholesterol level of 269. I immediately went on the McDougall, what we call McDougalling, and 3 months later, I had it checked again, and to my surprise, it was up to 280, and I thought, I got to be doing something wrong. I'm off milk, and I'm not a meat eater anyhow, and fruits and grains and nuts, I feel like, I'm out grazing.
Well, what would you tell
them? The cholesterol is not moving.
What would you tell them, Robert?
It's going the wrong way.
You must see this in people, particularly after they leave the clinic. They say, I'm not responding. I'm getting worse. What do you tell them?
Well, first of all, I want to make sure that the cholesterol test was accurate.
I had it checked twice.
Yeah, but I'm just saying that some labs belong to the Center for Disease Control, and they have standardization, and there can be tremendous error within the lab. So the first thing I want to make sure is I'd rule out a lab error. The second thing I would do is if you are some people, there is about a 3 or 4% of the population that we have seen whose cholesterol levels are not affected by, well, not take the same response to diet that others will. About 95% of people can get a tremendous reduction in cholesterol on these types of programs. About 3 or 4% will have a tough time. But it doesn't mean you shouldn't stay on the diet. And I'll give you a perfect example why. If you look at a person in Thailand that's on a low-fat, low-cholesterol diet, 10% fat diet, and you look at a person there with a 250 or 300 cholesterol level, they have a much lower incidence of heart disease than an American with that same cholesterol level. And the reason is they may have a genetic problem that's keeping their cholesterol up, but because they're on a low-fat, low-cholesterol diet, it's lowering a whole host of other risk factors that are predisposing them to the disease. Because remember, this isn't just a single risk factor disease. It's not just cholesterol. So even if you're having trouble getting your cholesterol level down, you may have some kind of a resistance to it. You're still doing yourself a world of other benefits
by being
on a low-fat diet.
I know I feel much better, but when I still see I forget whether it's HDL or LDL, I see those numbers up in the stratosphere and the triglycerides. I thought it was my telephone number.
Oh, your triglycerides are elevated?
Yeah.
Oh, we got some good news.
Huh?
Then we have some good news. We need to get you on a good exercise program. There's a number of ways that we can get your triglycerides down. First of all, you can't burn your cholesterol because it's not something that you metabolize.
Uh-huh.
But you can burn your triglycerides, and you need to get on a good walking program. What you need to do is start a daily walking program where you're walking a few miles a day briskly. That'll help your triglycerides. The other thing that'll help your triglycerides is to eat frequently. If you eat one meal a day or two meals a day, if you're eating a couple meals a day rather than frequently through the day,
right,
that will tend to elevate your triglycerides.
Oh.
So you want to eat frequently.
Okay.
The other thing that you might want to do is to make sure that you're not drinking alcohol. Alcohol can raise your triglycerides.
How about wine?
Wine will do it too.
Terrific.
Unfortunately, that has alcohol in it.
I'm doing the wrong thing.
And you might want to watch that you're not eating a lot of simple sugars. If you're eating a lot of simple sugars, white sugar, brown sugar, honey, molasses,
uh-huh,
those will raise your triglycerides. And
Frosted flakes with soy milk doesn't make it.
No, and 20% of your triglycerides converts into the VLDL fraction of cholesterol, and you will raise your cholesterol level by having an elevated triglyceride.
Gentlemen, thank you very much.
This goes to show, John, by the way, how a lot of people think that they can be following a low-fat diet, can be making some serious errors and not getting their levels down.
That would have been the first question I would have had is actually, what are you eating? Because, you know, people call themselves vegetarians and eat chicken and fish, and then some people who do understand they're not supposed to eat the animal products get into the simple sugars, and also too much fruit and fruit juice will raise triglycerides too.
Fruit juice will definitely raise triglycerides. Yeah.
So I think just a little bit closer attention to what the rules really are, Ed, you'll get exactly the results you're looking for. The program works well, and when you get your triglycerides down, that's what helps lower your cholesterol.
Okay.
And the only thing I would add to that is if you did not respond to real strict diet and exercise program, I would ask you to consider using cholesterol-lowering medications.
Yeah. That was the next point.
That was going to be the next thing right after the next cholesterol check.
I'll tell you what I might suggest is if you don't have some success in getting this down, give me a call at the center and give me a 3-day diary of what you've done. Write down what you ate and when you ate it, and let me take a look at it, because there might be something really obvious that'll pop out.
Let's talk to Dan. Dan, you're on the line with Robert Pritikin.
Hello?
Yes, Dan.
Dean.
Dean, okay.
Dean, John, this is Dean Hawley. I don't know if you remember me. I sold you and your family all your ski equipment.
Oh, my goodness.
How you doing?
Where have you been?
Fine.
This man owns Santa Rosa Ski and Sport, Robert.
I used to. I sold out to my brother.
Oh, you did?
But it's still going strong, doing real good.
Well, good. Congratulations. How are you doing with your health now?
Oh, great. My wife and I both have been on your diet for about 2 months now.
And what happened?
Well, we're on at about 90, 95%, I'll be honest. One of the reasons, we're doing great. I mean, I feel a lot better. My cholesterol dropped over 100 and something points. Triglycerides are down. I mean, we're following it real close. And I just wanted to say I appreciate what you and Robert both are doing to promote good health. I mean, I think it's a great deal. I have a 2-year-old daughter, and when she gets a little older, we'll start her a little more aggressively on this type of a program.
Well, that's good. Robert, what do you think about 90% on the diet?
Well, I'll tell you how I try to live on the diet, John. I try to stay on it all the time because it's easier. Some people are able to oscillate back and forth. I find it easier just to stay on the program. I don't know how your psychology works with you, but at home I have a perfect house. There's nothing in the house that's not on the program. And the reason for it is that in the evening, I get home from work and it's late at night. I can't even spell the word willpower. I don't want to have things in there that aren't healthy because you find yourself subconsciously eating them. So it's, you know, last night I got home. I wanted something to eat. I had some bean dip in those baked tortilla chips. It felt great. What if I had had fried ones in there?
Yeah, oh, you're going to eat. Hungry means eat.
Yeah, I surround myself with healthy opportunities.
Well, I don't, you know, the only time Carrie and I, my wife and I, eat bad is the special occasions. That's what I mean about the 90-95% on the diet.
Good.
I mean, we stick to it pretty regimentally.
And I want to point out something, too, Robert, with Dean. I mean, he and I have known each other for, well, I've been in Santa Rosa 5 years buying ski equipment from him. And so we've known each other that long. And yet, you know, it just takes time. I mean, he kept working at it and working at it and working at it. And I'm just so pleased that finally you and Carrie got around to really putting the program in. And you have a child. And, Robert, you have one or two children?
No, I'm the only predicate in the family that doesn't have kids.
Oh.
Well, all my siblings have a ton of them, though.
Well, then we can't ask about children until you and your wife get a little bit further along the line, I guess. Because we'd like to hear your feelings. Maybe you can just give us some feelings based upon how other members of your family react to kids. You were raised on a low-fat, almost vegetarian diet. What do you think about this for kids?
Well, it certainly worked out well for me. And you know, when I was a kid growing up, I used to run 30 to 50 miles a week, so I was able to stay in very good shape. All of the kids in my family, all the boys, got to be 6 feet, so we didn't turn into be stunted because we weren't eating fat or meat or those types of things. So I think it's a very good program for children. I obviously wouldn't put a one-year-old child on a low-fat diet. I think you need to wait till the child's a couple years old so that it gets beyond that stage. But I think that children do very well on a low-fat diet. I know it's very controversial. I mean, there's a lot of controversy in the medical field on whether children should be on a low-fat diet or not.
We keep getting the message from the doctors, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that. And then I listen to you guys and... You know, so there is a lot of controversy.
Tremendous.
But the controversy, I think, is around the fact that brain development requires fat.
Exactly.
And children under the age of 2 need a high-fat diet. Well, that's obvious. They should be on breast milk, which is
50% fat.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's no contrary information from my point of view.
No. After all, mothers, a young baby can be having as much as 100 milligrams of cholesterol a day from mother's milk. It's a lot, but they need that for brain development.
But after 2... they do just fine, but of course we're a little bit more liberal on the fat intake of our kids because they can tolerate it better. But you don't have to be if you got a fat kid. Keep them strict.